Our final speaker this morning is Scott DeVoe, who received his A.B. in music from Princeton and his Ph.D. from the University of California, Berkeley. Excuse me. He has been teaching at the University of Virginia since 1983. He's a professional jazz pianist as well as a music historian with an emphasis on the history of jazz. His book, Bean and the Boys, Coleman Hawkins and the Development of Bebop, will be published by the University of California Press. I'd like to introduce then Scott DeVoe, who will speak on the recording industry and the emergence of bebop.
Thank you very much. It's really been kind of a thrill to be at a meeting like this where so many people know so much about recordings. My background is really quite different, coming from the music history and music performance, and I hope you'll take this as something of a novice's journey on my part through some of the issues that I ran across trying to do my own research into the area of the transition between swing and bebop in the late 1930s and early 1940s. I found it to be, when I first started, well, it is a very complicated historical problem. There's a lot of things going on. You can approach it purely from a musical standpoint. But the two types of jazz represented by swing and bebop, despite the obvious stylistic connections between them, are so fundamentally different in many respects that I found a purely musical discussion to be inadequate to describe the changes going on. Obviously, with the swing bands, you have large dance orchestras that, while certainly conveying very interesting music, are embedded into the very fabric of popular culture. When you get to the bebop small combos, they're playing a fairly complex, intellectual, and perhaps austere kind of music, which in some cases scrupulously avoids any connotation of entertainment. So there are a lot of complicated issues going on. And what I was particularly interested in was the process of transition itself, not so much the end product of bebop, although I'm very interested in that as well, but what I really wanted to get at was the various stages that the new style to be had to pass through before it was finally recognized, not just by the public, but maybe by the people who were making it, as something new and independent, as well as the factors that affected and shaped this music on its way. And of course, any music historian is going to be looking to recordings as the prime source for finding out what was going on. And what I discovered early on was that the recorded evidence for the transition is frustratingly spotty and incomplete. Most of what we know about what went on in the transition comes from oral history, from musicians telling us what they were doing at experimental jam sessions in uptown Harlem, places like Minton's Playhouse and Monroe's Uptown House. There's almost a folklore as to what went on, but we don't really get a chance to hear much of anything until bop recording itself starts, I would say, the earliest, 1944, certainly by 1945. And when I tried to figure out why, there was one explanation that I kept running into over and over again, and it is the obvious one. It's the recording ban that James C. Petrillo imposed beginning in August of 42, which lasted completely until the end of 1943, and which, of course, lingered in some of its effects until Victor and Columbia signed at the end of 1944. It seems to match the problem that I've described very neatly. It takes the problem of the lack of documentation for the transition to bebop and throws it into the much larger gap left by the recording ban. The recording ban then ends up being something like a curtain that falls right in the middle of the most interesting part of the play. And by the time the curtain rises again, everything's changed, and we don't exactly know why. If I may be allowed to simplify things musically, before the ban, music sounds like this. Yeah, it's not exactly from 42, but I'm just using that. Right. Okay, well. Okay, granted. And after the band, of course, then you get... This is also not... This is from Recording band, that of course is Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker on the tune Coco from toward the latter half of 45. The band is obviously an important factor, but it has unfortunately become the habit for a number of writers, fortunately not including some of the people at this conference like Martin and like Dan Morgenstern, to sweep a lot of interesting problems under the rug of the recording band by blaming Petrillo for the lack of recordings and leaving it at that. I don't want to bore you with a lot of this kind of writing, which unfortunately is found in a lot of standard surveys that are read by a lot of people. I'll just give you one that I'm choosing because it's the most recent and it's also very concise. It comes from the new Rolling Stone History of Rock, which called Rock of Ages, which is reasonably serious in intent and has a chapter on currents in jazz and rhythm and blues before the emergence of rock, and it's just one sentence, I'll quote, Petrillo's strike ensured that the early efforts of jazz musicians to forge the new sound that would become bebop by the war's end never got recorded. I don't want to jump on this statement particularly, but I do want to use it as a point of reference for trying to go a little bit beneath this, what really could be called a cliche, to look at some of the things that were going on here with the problem of documentation. First of all, obviously, the statement is incomplete. There, some early efforts did get recorded commercially. A lot of the people that we might call bebop pioneers, like Gillespie and Parker, worked with swing bands and can be heard in records made before 1942, or 1942 and before. This is obviously what the system is geared to produce, and if you want to hear what Gillespie was up to, up through 1942, you can listen to these records much as you could find out, say, a decade earlier, what Coleman Hawkins was up to by listening to records with Fletcher Henderson. And, of course, one good place, reissue to start with for this thing is the this kind of thing is the Smithsonian Dizzy Gillespie Development of an American Artist. I'm going to just give an idea of some of the things going on then by listening to two examples from Gillespie during his period with some of the swing bands. The first being from recording made with Cab Calloway of the tune Hard Times. Now this will not be the studio recording, but an air check made in, I believe, July of 1940. A good example of Gillespie as a swing soloist, very much still in the Roy Eldridge mold, very adept harmonically, and certainly that element of his music is something that surfaces long before some of the other things. It's a very well-constructed and also very well-planned solo. Those of you who may be familiar with the studio recording, but not as much with this, will notice that it's quite similar in general, in its general outlines. There's really not a great deal of variation from it. I also, perhaps some of you people can explain this to me, I take this from, I can't remember what the record reissue label is, but somewhere in the bridge there are about two beats missing, and I don't really understand why, and having seen some of these discussions at yesterday afternoon's panel about what people do with things. I'd be very curious if someone can explain to me where those two beads went. Gillespie was with Calloway for about another year, and thereafter he started on a kind of a freelance career and made records somewhat more irregularly. One of them was with the Les Height Band, a tune called Jersey Bounce, probably recorded sometime around June of 1942. This solo, which is much briefer than the one we just heard, begins with similar, fairly simple gestures that are very much more in the rhetoric of swing playing, but soon unfolds into a long phrase of continuous rapid 16th notes and the kind of unexpected accents that we now recognize as being the integral or the foundation for the bebop style. Let's listen to that. Now, the question we want to know is what happens in between to affect this change in his playing. Well, Dizzy tells us this himself in his autobiography. He explains it. He says he's going out jamming. And I'll quote, he says, "I was always into something else outside. Playing with Cab was my job. Cab frowned on the ideas of guys going out jamming, but I went anyway. In the different towns we'd visit, I'd go out and blow. People would say, he's with Cab Calloway. Cab didn't like that. But I'd sneak out anyway. Shoot, the heck with Cab." It's not exactly what he said, but it's close enough. "I was thinking about my own development. When we were in New York after the show, I'd go to Minton's and then to Monroe's Uptown House and jam until 7 in the morning." Well, of course, this is the kind of music that we'd like to hear, and it's this kind of music that I think that quotation meant when it said the early efforts never got recorded. Bebop obviously grows more out of jam sessions than it does out of the dance bands. It still retains important elements from that jam session heritage. The instrumentation of skeletal format of a rhythm section with just a handful of horns, the string of solos format without elaborate arranging, and again, this whole idea of detachment from the general atmosphere of entertaining. We would like to be able to trace the development of bebop out of the jam sessions of the early 1940s. But if we do so, we have to realize the lack of recordings of this has nothing to do with the recording ban. It has everything to do with the nature and function of the jam session itself. As Gillespie hints at in his statement, there are really two different aspects to a jazz musician's world at this during this period. On the one hand, there's the job, which of course is usually with the dance band. It's the source of income, also of social and professional identity. It's the whole point of, in a sense, of going into the music business in the first place, is to get a job of the sort, and that's the foundation for a musician's career. Complementing this is the more shadowy world of the jam session, which not all musicians necessarily participated in. I think most people have a general notion of what goes on in a jam session, the informal music making away from the job, usually after a job is completed for the evening. Can be very spontaneous, or it can be relatively organized, as it was at Minton's and Monroe's. Especially at Monroe's, that kind of club would often have almost a whole evening of entertainment, of which a house band and then sitting in by musicians coming in would be part of what was going on. Jam sessions were a form of recreation and escape, a chance to blow off steam, but just as important, especially for people like Gillespie, rather ambitious, there was simply an extension of his professional activities, a kind of auxiliary to his workplace, in some ways, in a sense, like the backstage area at a theater, a world which wouldn't exist without the main professional activity, but which develops a kind of life of its own, with important functions for the professionals involved. Cutting contests, where people are competing to establish informal rankings, or in some cases very serious rankings. Experimentation and the idea of exploring new ideas and problems of musical technique. And what we might call, in modern slang, networking, simply being there to see and be seen, an important way for a lot of musicians to get jobs. All of this was really internal to the musicians' community and was not meant for public consumption. In practice, that boundary is not very easy to define. There's almost always was some kind of audience, often, if only, other members of the entertainment community. And as the swing era gained momentum in the 30s, curiosity about what really went on backstage made wider audiences eager to see jamming and jam sessions for themselves. But if that boundary between private and public that I outlined seems somewhat porous and perhaps a little too theoretical, it was there, and if there was a kind of border patrol along that boundary, it was the musicians' union. In their eyes, jamming was playing without pay, and that violated the whole foundation of what the union was all about. And they ended up tolerating jamming when it took place in relatively inaccessible places or places that are more or less defined as being within the musicians' community, and then cracked down on it regularly when it spilled over into the general public, often with good reason, because there are club owners who would exploit the tendency of musicians to simply sit in, and then there would be large paying crowds without musicians receiving anything from it. Where this leads to as far as bebop is concerned, I think the most important thing being the contributing to the development of what might be called the public jam session, a kind of staged version of the real thing, which for the musician really becomes simply another type of job. And there are many examples of that. And if you combine that with the growing number of jobs in clubs on New York's 52nd Street as you get into the war years, it makes it feasible for musicians to begin to leave the dance bands behind and make a living out of playing the kind of music that they play in jam sessions, which is very different from what would be played in the dance orchestras. And ultimately, I think this is what happens with bebop, is these opportunities opening up. But not really until 44 and 45. Until that point, what goes on at Minton's and Monroe's is still very much behind-the-scenes kind of activity. The experimentation is not yet an end in itself. I think of it as being more of a means, just a way of exploring ideas, but it's not yet the finished product. In my interviews, I've talked to Leonard Gaskin, who is the bass player at Monroe's Uptown House, and he talks about doing things with drummer Max Roach, like playing in a meter of five, 1-2-3-1-2, 1-2-3-1-2, which is the kind of thing that doesn't really come out in public in jazz until the 1950s, but which they would do there just to kind of loosen themselves up and to challenge themselves. That's an extreme example, perhaps, but a lot of this stuff was perhaps not really ready for recording, which was a very public act. Of course, the irony of all that is that some of these jam sessions were recorded privately by a gentleman named Jerry Newman. I'm sure many of you are familiar with these recordings made on portable disc recording equipment, which gives some few glimpses of what was going on circa 1941 in places like Minton's and Monroe's. They're extremely valuable to have. They unfortunately don't give us all we might want because they're a little early on, especially insofar as it concerns the development of bebop ensemble style. I wanted to play my favorite moment from these recordings, which features this particular snippet features Thelonious Monk, who was the house pianist at Minton's, a good example of a musician who really spent in this period all of his time backstage and thus was not to be heard on commercial recording. Even at Minton's, he wasn't heard much because as the pianist in the house band, he was spending a lot of time accompanying everyone else who came in. But on this one cut, which is a version of Sweet Lorraine, one of the favorite jam session standards, this begins unaccompanied. And it's an imaginative reworking on Monk's part of this standard, which shows, I think it's especially valuable for showing how original Monk's harmonic language was even at this very early stage. And it's interesting. He starts unaccompanied. The bass player tries to enter at several times, but can never really find a foothold in the shifting harmonies that Monk is playing. You notice he'll get to a place that sort of, he hits a place that coincides with the ordinary harmonic framework, and the bass will come in and very bravely start to make a sound on his instrument. But when Monk starts sliding away from it, he kind of goes into what could be described as musical muttering and stays out of the way until finally the drums come in and things settle down and it becomes altogether rather more ordinary. The trumpet player on this recording is Joe Guy, who was also a member of the house band in this period. Short of time, so I'm just going to try to condense the last part of my paper to cover the main point I wanted to get to for things after the recording band. Obviously, some of the innovations from these jam sessions start to filter into the dance orchestras, the 1943 Earl Hines band that Martin mentioned being the classic example, and it's certainly possible that had the recording band not been in effect, that things might have been very different. Talking with Martin just a few days ago about this, he brought up the interesting point that if, say, a record from that band, Dizzy's arrangement of Night in Tunisia had become a popular hit and these people had become, in a modest way, stars, that might very well have drastically changed the way that bebop, or what we now call bebop, would have developed and would have been presented to the public. But instead, that's not really the way it worked, and the direction by which bebop entered the public ear was more through musicians bypassing the dance orchestras and presenting jam session-style material directly to the public in the form of small combos. Dizzy Gillespie being by far the shrewdest as far as business was concerned and the most ambitious and being the one to get this off the ground. The group that he co-led with Oscar Pettiford at the Onyx Club beginning in December of 43 is often referred to, and I think rightly, as the first bebop combo, presenting the new style of soloing along with a fairly coherent ensemble style and the new repertory, pieces like Salt Peanuts and Night in Tunisia. The important thing that I think is well known to jazz specialists and undoubtedly to many of you, but not emphasized enough, is that that decisive move of the music into a public form coincided with the dramatic change in the record industry. That was not the recording band itself, but the circumstances under which it was resolved. And since I think a lot of you are familiar with this, I'll just try to move through this rather quickly. The idea being that when Decca signed at the end of 1943, all other companies who wanted to agree to those terms were free to do so. Now, I don't think Petrillo was even really thinking about small companies, but obviously this gave them an opening. Which was quite lucrative for a while, in the sense that demand was still very high from the skyrocketing demand that was experienced in 41 and 42. Output was artificially restricted by shellac problems and manpower problems in pressing plants, and that basically ensured that whatever they produced would get sold. Now, to try to compete directly against the majors in their territory of mainstream pop song and dance was a risky business, I guess, as far as finances and having to develop artists to replace since many of them were still under contract. And the fact that Capitol was able to do it is something of the exception that proves the rule. Most of the companies were just hoped in the long run, I think, to try to establish a presence in one of the specialty markets, race records, hillbilly, polka, Latin American, whatever, while in the short run making as much money recording anything they could in this brief period. One area that showed promise, obviously, was hot jazz, the small combo jam session format. Several companies specializing in hot jazz run by jazz enthusiasts already existed, like Commodore, Blue Note, and Signature, and other companies jumped on the bandwagon, obviously realizing that many ways recording jazz was extremely convenient and suited their circumstances. The fact that it was relatively inexpensive, the demand for jazz already existed, they could sell those records for premium prices, which, given the limited output, it made sense to sell each one for as much as you could get. All of this makes 1944 a boom year for the recording of small group jazz. Now, this doesn't hit the bebop musicians immediately. 1944 is actually more of a year of disappointment than anything else, as small companies were more interested in jockeying to try to get better-known veterans of the swing era like Coleman Hawkins on disc. But eventually, by the time, and this is again largely through Dizzy Gillespie's ambition, by 1945 certainly, you have also the fact that there are many, many more companies out there, and there are now literally dozens of Coleman Hawkins records glutting the market, and people begin to realize they better look for some new faces. And so the combination of the rise in prominence of people like Dizzy Gillespie on 52nd Street, and he had also appeared with Billy Eckstein, the combination of that means that he starts recording very heavily around in January of 45 for a number of rather small, obscure labels, but these recordings nevertheless help to snowball the general effect of the bebop movement in 45. So, in summary, it's interesting to note that jazz artists were among the first beneficiaries of the decentralization of the recording business in the wake of the recording ban, gaining an access to recording studios which would have been unlikely only a few years earlier. Musicians often had to deal with substandard recording and pressing equipment, unscrupulous company owners, and inadequate systems of distribution, but even on the less reputable labels, they were generally free to select their own personnel and repertory with the minimum of interference, and companies like Savoy, Blue Note, and Dial soon came to be symbols of the new music. Through their recordings, young musicians across the country heard and assimilated bebop, and the vigorous musical activity of the post-war years was preserved. None of this was the intention of James Petrillo, perhaps, when he called the recording ban that broke the monopoly held by the major companies, but it's clear that far from stifling musical development, the recording ban, or at least the way that it ended in, partially ended in 1943, actually helped to clear the way for the preservation and dissemination of modern jazz. Thank you. Any questions? it's time for lunch. Okay. Thanks a lot.
I'd like to thank all our fine speakers this morning for a most entertaining and informative morning session. And again, thank Carl Scheele and the staff of the National Museum of American History for their kind hospitality. We're still on. I can inform you that there is, first one quick announcement. If Dorothy Schrader, Patrick Daly, or Earl Martis are here, if they could come to the front, please. Michael Beale would like to speak with them. There is a cafeteria in this museum, if you haven't discovered it yet. Turn right at the pendulum and go downstairs. There's a large cafeteria there. That might be the quickest way to obtain lunch before you enter the heat outside and then the heat of the afternoon sessions on copyright and fair use issues and on Latin American music, as well as Spanish musical sources of Carmen. So see you this afternoon. Again, the venue is the Continental Room, the third floor of the Marvin Center, where we met yesterday.